Paul Rubinstein's hands shook as he held the Schmeisser. He was cold because his coat was partially open in order to protect the submachine gun's action from the freezing rain. Under a rain poncho, which had become stiff as board, he kept an M16. But he wanted the Schmeisser just as ready to fire, warmed by body heat and dry, as was the Browning high power he wore in the tanker holster on his chest. The M16 was one of many score of M16s that had passed through his hands since the night of the war. But the Schmeisser, or German MP40, as he knew it was more correctly called, had been with him since that first battle. He could still remember.
Here, use this for now.
John reached into the pile of weapons assembled on the ground near the jetliner crash site, weapons taken from the dead brigands. John killed 11 men and one woman while fighting to save the passengers, outlaw bikers, all of them, bent on lawlessness and death.
This is a 9mm, one of the best there is.
John gestured toward what Paul Rubinstein was about to learn was a German MP40 submachine gun, there on the ground beside him.
There should be plenty of 9mm stuff available.
John ruminated softly about the compatibility between the two guns. It was Greek to Paul Rubinstein then, even more unintelligible than Greek, because at least Paul knew how and what to order in a Greek restaurant if he needed to. Despite the fact his father had been a career Air Force officer, Paul never had any experience with firearms of any kind. It simply never came up. Yet suddenly his whole life was changed. He would have to learn. As Paul crouched near the helicopter, waiting for the inevitable, if indeed a group of Soviet personnel were advancing on the helicopter, he thought how strange it was. Before the night of the war, he walked the streets of New York City, some areas of the city possessed of almost incalculably high crime rates. He never thought to carry any sort of weapon. Since the night of the war, a handgun had become so constant a companion that he felt naked without one. He slept with one beside him. In his childhood, Paul never saw himself in the role of the hero, nor did he see himself that way now. He was a hero's sidekick, a thought that amused him. Should he get a battered old cowboy hat and wildly flamboyant red and white checkered shirt and ride a mule? Should he wear buckskins and ride a brown and white paint horse and speak in a unique mixture of perfect elegance and flawed syntax?
Yeah, right.
Of course, Paul never saw himself as a hero's sidekick either. He grew up without dreams of adventure. Sure, he enjoyed the same books and movies and television programs as his friends and the string of military-based schools he attended, but he never projected himself into the chase scenes, the gunfights, the hand-to-hand battles between good and evil. He supposed he'd been what kids of his generation called square. While other boys were planning to get tough and join the Marines or something, he planned on what extra courses he could take during the summer vacation period. All of that changed on the night of the war.
That's all over now.
This was reality, now. And for all the things of the old life he missed, in this life, he had his love with Annie, his friendship with Michael, Sarah, and Natalia, and most of all, with John Rourke. John Rourke recreated Paul. Without that, he would never have survived. Now, even in the darkest moments, moments where death might overtake him in the next instant, he knew life was too precious to surrender. John Rourke uncovered the action of the M16. It would be exposed to the icy rain. The rain was turning again to snow, but mixed with sleet, for only a few seconds. He moved the safety tumbler. With the howling wind and the crunch of ice under the boots of the 8 Soviet Marine Spetsnaz coming along the gap in the rocks, he didn't need to worry about making noise. He set the safety tumbler to full auto. John contemplated what made these men his enemies. The simple answer was that they wore the uniform of his enemy, the Soviet KGB. His fight with the KGB started 5 centuries ago, a continuing battle against men and women committed to an ideology John believed morally wrong. Their unblinking devotion to their ideology permitted any atrocity and then excused it through their dedication to the ideal. But John was not planning to kill them because they subscribed to an ideology, no. He intended to kill them for the most basic reason. If he didn't kill them, they would kill him.
Paul! Do you read me?
Loud and clear. Freezing my torso. Over.
Ditto here. On the way as we discussed. Out!
As soon as the 8 men passed him, he would open fire. With the wind, it was unlikely the sound of gunfire would travel that far. But there was no choice of method. If he and Paul were able to act quickly enough, none of the 8 would have time for a transmission. Otto Hammerschmidt was awake. Annie Rubinstein pulled a surprisingly lightweight plastic chair nearer to his bed and sat down beside him.
You saved my life, Frau Rubinstein. You would have done the same for me, Otto. How are you feeling?
Hammerschmidt's blue eyes were slightly watery-looking, she imagined because of medication.
I am feeling well, all things considered. The doctors here tell me that I will be up and about in a very short time, and that is good. I wish to rejoin my men.
Annie just looked at him, the silence so intense.
And how is the Fraulein Major?
She's not well, Otto, but we're going to try to fix that. A Dr. Rothstein and I.
What?
There's a psychotherapy technique that may lead to some good results. He's of the opinion that I might be able to help because of, well, you know, the tricks I can do with my mind.
She smiled as she rearranged her hands in her lap. Otto's eyes became more intense as he looked at her. The light from the small lamp over the bed bathed his face in a yellow glow.
I do not like the sound of that, Frau Rubinstein. What sort
of... We're going to play it by ear.
Annie's head still ached from what she did to prove to Rothstein she could help. Her stomach churned from it as well. It was terrifying to her.
By ear?
American expression. We'll kind of work things out as we go along. Now...
She stood up and smoothed her skirt. She leaned slightly over the bed.
You need your rest. They said I could only talk with you for 5 minutes, Otto.
And she bent over him, kissed him on the rough stubble of beard on his left cheek. She thought of Paul. She closed her eyes and opened them as she stood erect again.
Please, Frau Rubinstein, Annie.
She gave him a little wave as she walked to the doorway, opened the door, then stepped out into the hospital corridor and let the door close.
Oh.
She leaned against the wall as the door closed behind her, hugging her arms about her. Paul would not want her to do this. Her father, John Rourke, would not want her to do this. Still, she had to do it. She walked toward the two shore patrol officers waiting for her near the nursing station, listening to the clicking of her heels against the floor surface, trying to focus her attention on the sound they made. Entering Natalia's mind, if she could do that, really frightened her. There would be secrets inside Natalia that were not things she, Annie, should know, had no right to know, things about her father, perhaps. But even more than that, she was frightened of the secrets in her own mind. What could she really do? The Marine Spetsnaz corporal at the very rear of the 8-man file fell back, addressing some problem with his equipment. John Rourke, despite the cold that racked his body, shifted quickly out of his parka and wrapped his rifle in it. His body shook as he moved through the swirling snow and sleet, whirlwinds of icy darts surrounding him. He relied on the warmth emanating from his armpits and the superior construction of the stainless steel Detonics combat masters to keep them from freezing up. In his right hand, held like a saber, was the Life Support System 10, its 12-inch steel blade already coated with a thin film of ice. John Rourke moved quickly. It was that or freeze to the spot where he stood, and with each step there was crackling ice, the sucking sounds of the slush, rapidly freezing, trying to close around his feet as the temperature dropped again and the wind increased. The Spetsnaz corporal was adjusting a strap on his backpack. His rifle, an AKM-96 of the type Rourke had come to know so well in the short period since his first encounter with these men, was already frozen shut with ice. The man moved so slowly, Rourke realized, because he was nearly freezing to death. John Rourke stepped up behind him, reached out and cupped his left hand over the Spetsnaz corporal's mouth, lest the man cry out. Rourke drove the point of the LX-10 into the Russian's kidney, like a stake through the heart of a vampire. Paul saw them coming. John said 8 men. He saw only 7. Why? Paul slowly moved the Schmeisser from the protection of his coat, drawing back the bolt over the magazine. He cupped his left hand over the open action, lest it ice up.
Only 7?
For an instant, in the light of the flashlight one of the men held, Paul saw a soldier's face. It was gray, like the face of a walking dead man. One of the men at the lead of the file evidently spotted the helicopter gunship. He moved, gesticulating toward it, but so slowly it was apparent the man seemed to be dying on his feet. One of the men started to raise his rifle. Paul Rubinstein shoved the Schmeisser forward to fire. The 8th man appeared at the rear of the file.
Sons of bitches!
But the 8th man wasn't wearing a pack, and the blackness of his Arctic gear looked different than that of the other 7. The 7 turned toward the 8th man. Paul recognized the familiar sound of an M16. Paul broke from his hiding place in the rocks, veered left fast so he'd be on a tangent to the 7, but out of line with the 8th man when he fired. 2 men were down, now 3. Paul uncovered the Schmeisser. 1 man, then another. A 6th man went down, spinning into the slush with a violent splash. The 7th man's rifle fired wildly. Paul fired as John Rourke fired. The man's body lifted off its feet and was thrown into the rocks behind him. Paul walked forward, a dozen rounds or so remaining in the submachine gun. He shifted it to his left hand, drew the Browning high power, and thumbed back the hammer.
John!
I'm all right! You?
Yeah, I think!
They had just killed 7, probably 8 men. Paul Rubinstein stopped walking, less than a dozen yards from John Rourke.
This was too easy! These men were half dead from exposure! They weren't looking for us! They were getting away from something here on the island, or running to something, maybe. We have to find out. Let's go inside and warm up for a while. We can't take off in this.
Right.
What would 8 Soviet Marine Spetsnaz be running away from on an island the size of a dozen or so football fields? Or running to? There was no talk of burying the dead men. The ice and snow would have them buried soon enough, but John began digging through their pockets, and Paul Rubinstein crouched down into the freezing slush to help him. Huddled together with blankets wrapped around them, they sat just aft of the cockpit, steaming mugs of coffee made with the microwave immersion heater in the console before them. Under the glow of the overhead lights, John and Paul studied the few personal effects they took from the bodies of the 8 Marine Spetsnaz soldiers.
What's this say, John?
John took the notebook and leafed through it.
It's a diary.
I hate this.
Yeah, I know, so do I. It's mainly personal things. He missed his girl.
Paul stood up.
Wait. He says here that he was frightened because of the secrecy surrounding the installation. He wasn't even being told where they were going. He was worried that if something went wrong, the destruct mechanism was so powerful they'd all be killed. And if something went wrong, they would retrieve them.
Rourke looked at Rubinstein.
That's all he says about it.
Some sort of installation. For what? In here?
Well, if they came from the north, no.
Going out into that again isn't my favorite thing in the world.
No, you stay here with the machine.
Wait a second, I can...
If there's an installation of some sort here, then there's a substantial likelihood more of them will be out there and could find us. One of us has got to stay. I got more background in Arctic survival than you, and I'm a physician, so I can heal myself.
But you can fly the helicopter.
Not in this. No, you stay here. Keep a sharp eye on that intruder system. I'll dress as warm as possible. You wrap up an M16 for me to keep it dry. I'll get started. Damn good coffee.
The coffee was hot. It felt good. Rourke walked at a steady pace, neither so fast as to build up perspiration, nor so slowly as to allow the cold to get at his muscles. His progress was complicated by the uncertain footing. Ice ridges everywhere, snow falling in what amounted to sheets, driven on a wind Rourke gauged at gusting to well over 40 miles per hour. But this time, John Rourke planned ahead. Beneath the Arctic parka, he wore thermal underwear, cotton-knit shirt, dry BDU pants, and the midweek equivalent of a wool commando sweater. The cold-weather pants that went with the parka helped considerably, as did the Arctic boots. He didn't like hats. In fact, he went out of his way to avoid them. So beneath the hood of his parka, he wore a silk neck scarf. It was long, like the ones aviators of the first two World Wars sometimes wore. This one was black. Wound over his head and around his neck to cut the wind, it was a gift from the premier of the first Chinese city. Beneath the Arctic gloves, he wore black silk gloves, a comfortable and precise fit to his hands. With them, he could untie a small knot or pick up a dime, had anyone made dimes anymore. Aside from knots and coins, the gloves were as good as bare skin on a gun and protected the hands from winds like none other he had ever used. He experimented with them as he walked.
Yeah, nice design.
As he walked on, one level of his attention focused on the possibility of a chance encounter with more personnel fleeing this mysterious installation. On another level, he kept his mind involved in order to minimize the mental discomfort associated with exertion in such cold. John reviewed the steps for various surgical procedures he hadn't recently performed or had never been called to perform other than on a cadaver when in medical school.
Retract and apply suction to the wound.
When these became no longer so demanding of his concentration, he began to review the surgical procedures mentioned in the German and Midweek journals he had studied. They were so logical in some cases that he was amazed he and the other physicians of his era never tried them or thought to try them. He dearly wanted the opportunity to practice medicine, more than he had ever wanted it in his life. Techniques existed now that conferred healing powers upon the physician that in earlier ages, like that in which he had been schooled, would have seemed miraculous. The power to save lives was greater than it had ever been.
Why are my days, then, so consumed with taking lives?
At last, in the distance, he saw a darker shape against the darkness.
Be on guard, John.
As he advanced against it, he left the M16 in its German assault rifle drop case. The Detonix 45s were accessible to him quickly enough, and he had no intention of walking into trouble. He took a tangent from the natural trail in the rocks. He slipped as he scrambled up, caught himself, and continued on, toward the ridgeline lost in the darkness above him. He wanted to see what he was walking into. As he glanced north, the shape seemed more defined, though no more discernible as to its nature. He kept climbing. Annie Rourke Rubinstein stood at the foot of Natalia's bed, her hands in the pockets of her skirt, her eyes on Natalia's face. Her friend was lost. Annie might have the ability to bring her friend home. If a person was lost, and lost somewhere where there might be danger, it was inherent to the situation that to go out and attempt to find the person and bring the person back might have some danger to it as well. Annie remembered when she first woke her father, her mother, Paul, and Natalia from the sleep, simply because Michael was lost and in danger. They found Michael. This was the same. Only this time, Annie's father, John Rourke, was not the one to go searching. She was. No one could do this job better than she. Annie knew Natalia intimately, and alone had the ability to penetrate the territory into which Natalia had disappeared. No special knife, no special gun, not even a compass. Annie doubted she would really need the hypnosis, but at least in that way there might be someone to help bring her back should she too become lost in Natalia's nightmare world. Dr. Rothstein, perhaps out of embarrassment that she so clearly read his thoughts, or perhaps out of a true perception of the urgency, Natalia was slipping farther and farther away, agreed to try some preliminary experiments the next day. There was additional urgency to the matter. Should her father or husband reach Midwake before the procedure began, either of them might forbid it. In that case, Annie would remind them it was not their decision to make. But she didn't want to have that confrontation. Annie Rourke Rubinstein closed her eyes.
I'm coming, Natalia. I'm coming to help you. I may need you to help me, Natalia, but I'm coming anyway.
Annie opened her eyes. She took her hands out of her pockets, and she walked out of the room. From the top of the ridgeline, John could see the installation clearly enough, but its nature was still something he could not discern. Mesh barriers of plastic sheeting stood staked out near to the fences. It looked like snow fencing, but inadequate to the task. A blockhouse or bunker lay within the fenced area, and there, in open view on either side of the bunker, were batteries of what appeared to be capped missile-launching tubes from a nuclear submarine. What he was looking at was an installation of at least 12 nuclear missiles. The door of the blockhouse stood open. The swirling snow danced in the glow of a yellow light shining from within. John Rourke stood up, for the moment ignoring any danger to himself. He started walking along the ridgeline, looking for the nearest point to begin his descent. At last, he found a natural defile. Slowly, lest he slip on the ice and break something, he began climbing down.
This is the submarine. Aircraft crew, do you read me? Over.
Jason Darkwood from the island-class submarine Arkhangelsk was trying to raise John and Paul. Paul put down his journal and grabbed up the headset.
This is the aircraft. Reading you loud and clear, submarine. Over.
Aircraft, are you all right? Over.
We're surviving the storm, but unable to take off because of high winds. We were forced down due to mechanical problems. We've since corrected. We have some company here, possibly. But at least we weren't lonely. 8 visitors were made to leave abruptly. Do you roger that? How were things on your end? Over.
There was an engagement, but everything worked out satisfactorily. What do you want us to do to help? Over.
Be there if we need you. I have no more information. Over.
Roger that. Wilco, out.
Paul Rubinstein put down the headset. He looked at the German digital watch Otto Hammerschmidt gave him. John had been gone for a long time. John Rourke ran, the M16 freed of its case and in his right hand. He cut a zigzag pattern through the ice and snow toward the fence. The gate was open. He could see the missile tubes more clearly now, angled obliquely into the invisible sky above. Ice encrusted the far side of each tube, but the near sides were clear. Cocoon-shaped cylinders lay open in the ground, as if the tubes rose from them. The closer he got, the less doubt Rourke had. The gates to the compound were open, but John Rourke hesitated beside them. With the klaxon blaring, he realized he could be walking into something. He thought of the Marine Spetsnaz personnel who were sufficiently afraid of something that they tried to escape into the storm even though they were too weary to fight for their lives. He thought of the entry in the diary he and Paul found on one of the dead men. A destruct mechanism, an installation. An installation for what? The tubes.
Nuts!
Rourke broke into a dead run toward the shaft of diffused yellow light glowing from within the bunker. He slipped on the ice, caught his footing, and lurched ahead. The M16 tightened his right fist as he reached the bunker doorway. John Rourke flattened himself beside the building. He shifted the M16 to his left hand, tugged down the zipper with his right, then drew the Smith & Wesson Model 629 from the flap holster beneath his parka. Rourke moved into the doorway opening, the assault rifle and the .44 Magnum revolver ready. Three men lay dead on the floor. The exposed flesh of their bodies shone gray, their ragged wounds glistening in a yellow light, the blood coagulated in bizarre patterns only freezing imparted. A fourth man sat at a control panel with lights moving across it. The man was shot once in the head. There was no one else in the large single-room structure. John Rourke moved to the control panel.
Oh, they're set to launch.
No time to close the door. Rourke safed the M16 and propped it against the table as he shoved the dead man from the chair to the floor. The 629 went onto the counter before the control panel. Rourke pushed back the parka hood and the scarf. His ears and the exposed skin of his face quickly grew cold. He was tired from lack of sleep and needed the rush the cold would give him. In a short while, the cold would bring on numbness, sleepiness. But for now, the cold would help. And if not, the missiles would launch and everything would be over anyway.
Damn!
John pulled off the Arctic outer gloves. The black gloves beneath them were sensitive enough for the work.
A destruct system?
What had the dead man meant with his diary entry? That the destruct system might detonate the missiles? Or was it so powerful a system that it would kill anyone nearby? Had the Marine Spetsnaz personnel abandoned the facility out of fear of the launch or the mechanism? Rourke had to know. He searched the panels, reading each gauge. There was a timer. Was it for destruct or launch? The diode reading showed minutes descending, seconds, tenths and hundredths of seconds. He tried to understand the scenario. Was this an intentional launch, or, due to inexperience with this land-based system, was it just a horrible mistake? If it was a mistake, then the destruct mechanism would have been engaged as a last-ditch effort to abort the missiles. Did the Soviet power based beneath the sea want a launch now, against Midway? Wouldn't the missile impacts destroy the very volcanic vent from which both cities drew geothermal energy? Did the Russians think that way? Rourke holstered his revolver. He dropped to his knees beneath the counter and started dismantling the access space at the front of the cabinet. Launch or destruct? He started tracking wires. A single nuclear detonation, because of the fragility of the Earth's atmosphere, would destroy all remaining life on the planet. There were 12 missiles here. Were they about to fire?
Lord help us.
Annie sat up. She had fallen asleep, exhausted, despite the headache. But the headache was still with her, more intense. She'd been dreaming. She was the only one of them who dreamed consciously since the awakening. And when she dreamed, she saw her father. Her nightgown was stuck to her body with sweat. She hugged the blankets up around her. She was her father, and somewhere nearby, long tubes rose out of the ground, thrust up into the darkness. His hands moved with a desperate purpose, and there was a sound. The sound was loud, maddeningly intense. Her father wrestled with wires, lights, and switches, a bewilderingly complex jumble. His hands moved over the wires. He was thinking about her, about her mother, Sarah, about her brother, Michael, about Paul, about Natalia. He didn't know what to do. So many wires, he must find the right one. There were red lights forming a pattern of numbers, and the numbers were changing. The sound grew more intense. Then the dream ended. Annie's mouth was dry. Chills ran along her spine and across the top of her head.
Daddy?
She closed her eyes, sitting there in the darkness. She knew. The transceiver signal was weak, but the voice was clearly John's.
Paul! Get the helicopter airborne somehow! Make a pass toward the north of the island! There's a concrete blockhouse surrounded by a fence. 12 missile tubes, 6 on each side! If you see me in the yard and you can land, do it! If I'm not there, just fly off and... Hell, just fly off! Are you in contact with the Arkhangelsk? Over!
John, what's going on? Yeah, I'm in contact. What's wrong?
Alert the Arkhangelsk to contact Midway and take whatever precautions can be taken to evacuate! There are 12 missiles here and they're about to fire, Paul!
Paul dropped the radio handset, his stomach suddenly gone.
There's a destruct circuit. I think I've got it! When it goes, this island will go with it because of the fuel of the rocket engine. So that's all right, but the missiles might launch before the destruct sequences take over. The men we saw, they were trying to escape the island. The missiles were supposed to launch. I think it was some kind of mistake, and they sabotaged the destruct mechanism that would abort the missiles because they knew the island would go up and they'd go up with it. They killed their senior and non-coms and officers here. There's no time now. Look for me. Ow!
John! John! John!
Paul licked dry lips with a dry tongue. He put the handset down and put on the radio headset. He moved his hands over the gunship's controls as he began to talk.
This is aircraft calling submarine. Come in, submarine. Over.
He had to disconnect the cables before he could attempt to unlock the helicopter's pontoons from the ice.
Aircraft, what is wrong? Over.
Everything! Everything is wrong!
Emergency. Midwake is under attack. Emergency. This is not a drill. Emergency.
So what else is new?
Annie Rubinstein stood up, tried the light switch beside the bed. It still worked.
This is Rubinstein!
It was one of the shore patrol personnel assigned to stay with her.
Mrs. Rubinstein!
Yes?
Annie grabbed her robe, stuffed her feet into her slippers. She ran across the bedroom, through the sitting room, and opened the door.
Hurry!
The woman grabbed her arm and they ran. The dream. Her father hadn't made it. It was cramped beyond the access panel for the computer-linked launch controls of the missile battery. John Rourke's gloved hands were stiffening with the cold. He cut wires with the A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome knife. He reconnected wires with the pliers he found on the floor beside the access panel and the electrical tape that lay there as well. After the first few seconds with the access panel removed, John Rourke realized there was no way to stop the launch, and given the size of the missiles, they had to be fitted with nuclear warheads. With no way to abort the launch, the only alternative was to accelerate the destruct sequence, but it had been partially disabled. He bridged the circuit and moved on to the next. If he could wire the launch sequence into the destruct sequence, there would be enough time, perhaps.
Damn it, this better work.
The eight men John and Paul killed were clearly ignorant. With the missiles set to launch, the destruct sequence activated, they killed their leaders and cut through the destruct circuits with a bayonet or something. Perhaps a saw of some kind. But all they really did was disconnect the destruct sequence controls.
Idiots!
At least one of them evidently realized this, because there was a clearly botched attempt to reconnect the destruct sequence controls. With the destruct sequence disabled, they must have realized what they had done. They had made launch of the missiles inevitable. They ran, not knowing where, not knowing what would happen, only that somehow they had caused it. Activating the destruct sequence was a command decision, perhaps at this level or some higher one. Rourke was second-guessing them, but the logic of what he saw dictated nothing else. There was a degenerative fault in the wiring of the launch circuits. He saw it as he bridged another circuit. The system had several times started its own launch sequence and been shut down, only to start up again. It was a fault in the logic circuits of the computer through which the system ran. He didn't know the nature of the fault, and there was no time to find out.
Come on.
The destruct sequence was apparently activated to prevent the missiles from self-launching. It didn't work, and the missiles were about to launch now. It was also clear no one knew enough about sabotage to properly abort the launch sequence. The launch sequence ran through alternating circuits to prevent sabotage, and so complicated that attempting to disassemble it might override the proper launch sequence and simply launch. To disconnect the system would clearly trigger a launch by tripping a backup charge. There was no way to dissipate the charge, hence no way to kill the electrical supply and thereby cancel the launch.
Idiots leading imbeciles.
The circuitry at the heart of the system was self-healing. When a circuit was damaged, electricity run through the system bridged around it. If he connected the wrong wires at the stage he was now, both launch and destruct would be instantaneous and the missiles would get away.
Oh, damn!
Rourke's back ached, cramped in the small compartment. As he made another bridge, the self-healing process within the circuits activated, and he started to move his hands away. People moved everywhere under the indigo dome of one of the two primary living areas. It was the best section of Midwake in which to live, she learned from the two female shore patrol officers who brought her here. Senior officers of the submarine fleet used apartments here when they had shore leave or assignments keeping them at Midwake. The Better family residences were here as well. Everywhere she looked, as she moved beside her guardians across the grassy parkways, there were women in nightclothes, men in hastily put on slacks and shirts, barefoot or in slippers, carrying shoes or boots, dragging small children by the hand, burdened with sheets and pillowcases turned into sacks for a few precious belongings. United States Naval and Marine Corps personnel were everywhere as well, directing foot traffic, helping the elderly, the infirm, and the young.
The hospital! Natalia!
Annie turned to her shore patrol escort.
I've got to get my friend!
The hospital is being evacuated, ma'am! Don't worry!
But you don't understand! Natalia's so confused!
The female shore patrol holding her arm held on tighter.
We have to evacuate now, ma'am!
They were moving along a walkway toward a monorail station. The yellow sphere housing the headquarters of Family Services, Central Education Facilities, and Medical and Dental Services was in the next dome. That was where she would find Natalia. Already there were lines at the monorail station, but Annie's guardians passed ahead, their uniforms, all the badge of authority needed to take them to the head of the line. A woman with two small children was boarding ahead of them. The one child who was walking was dragging behind.
Let me.
Annie swept the little boy up into her arms. They were inside now. The car doors closed as the monorail train powered up. With a slight lurch, the train pulled away from the station. Annie stood, the two shore patrol officers on her right, the woman with her other child on the left as the train pulled into the central hub of the wheel. She knew it would be crowded, but as the train pulled in along the platform, she was amazed at the vast surging mass of people looking for other people. There were no living quarters here, only communications, administration, and energy facilities. But these were staffed 24 hours a day, and shift workers were trying to find loved ones who evidently promised to rendezvous with them here in the event of disaster. The train stopped. The doors opened.
Don't worry, ma'am. We don't have to change trains.
The doors were fully open. People jostled and squeezed past to exit and enter the train.
Why are the trains going that way?
Annie gestured with her head toward the rail on the other side of the platform.
And they're all empty.
Returning from the sub pens, ma'am, to get more people.
I see.
The doors were starting to close. Annie Rubenstein shoved the little boy she held into the arms of the shore patrol officer nearest to her and jumped for the doors. Her robe caught as the door closed. She jerked it free and ran through the chaos for the opposite side of the platform. She ran from her indigo-colored train, searching for a yellow one. Paul was soaked to the skin. Sleet mixed with snow blew across the flat rocks on which the helicopter sat. The mooring cables lay on the floor of the aircraft. As gusts buffeted the helicopter, it seemed to tilt, first in one direction, then another. If it overturned...
It's just better not tip over.
Paul, wet, cold, racked with chills, buckled in at the controls. He checked oil pressure, fuel mixtures, tried remembering everything John Rourke taught him. A smile crossed his lips.
Trigger control. Trigger control.
He throttled out. The helicopter slipped. The ice beneath the floats cracked, separated, and the metal strained. A gust slammed the aircraft on the port side.
Trigger control.
He held the controls with death grips, and the chopper gradually started to rise. John Rourke opened his eyes. His fingertips tingled. Mechanically, he checked his watch. The Rolex seemed unscathed. He would heal. It wouldn't. He sat up, slowly reviving from an electric shock.
Damn it.
He'd been thrown half out of the compartment behind the access panel. He crawled back inside, found the pliers and the tape. There were wires to cut. Already, some of the circuits he'd disconnected had rerouted themselves. The countdown continued, and there was no time to even check how much time was left. Annie Rubenstein sat alone on the monorail train. She focused her attention on the waste processing plants the train passed in the tunnel leading toward the Yellow Dome. Some Midway people called the city the Octopus, even though there were only six tentacles. Each tentacle was a tunnel ending at a dome. The head, where she escaped her guardians and boarded the yellow train, was the central core. The yellow station was coming up. Natalia. Wind shear, he thought they called it, but whatever it was, the wind was suddenly there, and the German helicopter gunship was no longer under his control. Banking hard to starboard, nose down, a sickening roar out of the rotor blades overhead, the gunship vibrated, shook, and trembled, like his hands. Paul Rubenstein tried to remember what John had told him. He didn't know if he remembered or was guessing, and there wasn't time to think. He gave the gunship full power, pulling back on the throttle, trying to bring up the nose. John Rourke's hands froze over the wires.
Launch imminent. Launch imminent. Evacuate immediate launch
shit.
Area. Shield
the destruct system was almost imminent. Wired into the launch system.
Launch
almost.
Imminent. Launch
a length
imminent.
Of blue wire evacuate traveled now from the destruct area. Controls shield to the launch controls.
Launch
to activate
imminent.
The destruct sequence,
launch
he had to fool the timer. His legs and back cramped from having been crouched and bent so long, his fingertips still tingled from the electrical shock. He scanned the control panel and found the timer readout. Time until launch was 93 seconds. No time to unscrew the housing around the timer. Rourke drew the grain LS-10 knife from its sheath at his hip and used the butt cap like a hammer. He shattered the timer readout and started counting the seconds in his head. With the pliers, he peeled back more of the housing around the timer. He dropped to his knees and crawled back behind the access opening to reach the blue wire. He lifted it, careful not to jerk it and disconnect it where he had bridged it.
87 seconds.
He fished the blue wire up to the timer housing. In the distance, there was a shaft of yellow light, and Paul Rubinstein could see smoke pouring from the tail sections of missiles.
Where's John?
As slowly as he could, he started to maneuver the gunship down, lest he lose control in the next gust of wind.
Midwake is under attack. Emergency.
Annie ran across the grassy area fronting the hospital. Men and women in military uniforms and hospital uniforms carried patients on stretchers. A woman in a white nurse's uniform and cap was directing human traffic from the head of the steps.
Major Shimarovna!
The woman turned, looked astonished to see her. Annie recognized her, the charge nurse from Natalia's floor.
Where's Natalia Shimarovna? Have you gotten her out yet?
The nurse ran down the steps, meeting Annie at the center.
Thank God you came! The German officer is trying to get her out of the room. She came out of the coma when the alarm was sounded. I don't know how she had all those sedatives.
What's happening?
She grabbed an orderly, was about to give her an injection. Somehow she got hold of his trouser belt. She has it around his neck. She's telling everybody to stand back or she'll kill him. She's laughing and crying at the same time.
Annie was past her and running up the steps.
The German officer.
Annie couldn't hear the nurse any longer over the sounds of the evacuation, over the blaring of the recorded message. John Rourke connected the blue wire into the timer, then advanced the timer by 10 seconds. 26 seconds remained to launch the missiles. 16 seconds until the destruct mechanism detonated, he hoped. He left the M16 and the Arctic gloves, more of both, aboard the aircraft. If he didn't reach the aircraft, he'd never need anything again. He reached the doorway.
Oh, shit!
On the counter beside the control panel was his knife. He ran back, grabbed the knife, and ran for the bunker doorway. He waved the knife in his hand as he ran to Paul in the helicopter.
6, 5.
The helicopter was coming in, sweeping over the fence line, slipping toward him. He had the knife sheathed.
4, 3.
John Rourke hunched his shoulders, ducked his head. He threw himself onto the port side float, hammering his fists against the fuselage.
Take her up! Take her up now!
The helicopter lurched, lifted.
1.
The ground on all four sides of the missile complex seemed to buckle. Fire belched skyward. John Rourke turned his face away. The helicopter lurched. Flames reflected off the chin bubble. The winds tore at him, numbing him. The heat updraft stifled him. Rourke held his breath and looked down. Rippling out from the missile complex in four directions, the explosions came. The center of the small island seemed to collapse.
Oh, God, no!
One of the missiles seemed to rise from its launch pad, then another. Rourke watched them, powerless. The center of the compound appeared to drop into the flames of the explosions. The remaining missiles toppled one by one as the flames licked up toward the gunship. Rourke's numbed hands clawed into the helicopter's floats.
Oh, merciful God, no!
Annie walked into the room. Otto Hammerschmidt looked as if he were about to keel over from pain or exhaustion. He sat on a plastic chair near the foot of the bed. Natalia stood, on the top of the bed, back to the wall. Half kneeling in front of her, a man about Annie's age, terror in his eyes, hands outstretched before him, a webbed belt twisted around his head like a noose, its end held in Natalia's upraised left hand. Natalia held her right hand at his chin, ready to snap the young man's neck. Natalia's hospital gown was half off her body. There was a look in her bright blue eyes Annie had never seen there before. Panic.
Natalia.
Frau Rubinstein.
Otto, it'll be all right. How are you?
I will be all right.
Annie focused on Natalia's face.
Natalia, it's me, Annie, and Otto's here too. That man, the man with you, he's only trying to help you.
Don't move!
Natalia flicked the orderly's chin upward with her right hand. The man's eyes bulged under the strain. The web belt went tighter. And he licked her lips.
Natalia, you know me, don't you? I mean, we're friends. Good friends.
Natalia's hair needed combing. She wore no makeup, but she was still so very beautiful. Annie eased one step forward.
Natalia, if you kill this man, it won't help us. Natalia.
She took another step.
He's on our side. We're here at Midwake together.
She took another step.
You've been so sick. Daddy will be so happy to...
Natalia's eyes went wider than they were. Her fingers tensed. Annie dove toward her, hit Natalia, body slamming her into the wall. Annie grabbed Natalia's right forearm to keep her from breaking the orderly's neck. They fell, all three of them, rolling over the side of the bed. Natalia's right hand flashed upward, and Annie dodged her head right, the heel of Natalia's hand skating over Annie's left cheek. Otto Hammerschmidt was suddenly in between them. Otto's left fist arced up into Natalia's jaw, driving her head up and back. Natalia's eyes closed, and her head slumped.
Oh, Gott in Himmel.
Otto fell to his knees. Annie crawled over Natalia, her fingers working to open the choking belt around the orderly's throat.
Calm down, it'll be all right.
The two shore patrol officers raced into the room, their pistols in their hands.
Freeze!
Annie looked up at them as she freed the orderly's neck from his belt. The female Navy cops held their pistols. Annie rocked back on her haunches and leaned against the side of the bed.
Be serious, huh?
Annie realized for the first time that somewhere between when she dove for Natalia and now, the impersonal female voice stopped broadcasting the warning.
The all clear is given. Secure from emergency status. The crisis is past. The all clear is given. Secure from emergency status. The crisis is past. The all clear is given.
They were warm inside. He was cold. But he knew their secret. Eight of his men died that he could know this secret. But the martyrs' names would be sung among the names of heroes of the Reich.
Hail the Fatherland.
Damien Rausch huddled within the thermal energy blanket from his kit. He had to stay where he was. Soviet aircraft made periodic patrols. The German forces, under the command of the traitorous Wolfgang Mann, prowled the area near the retreat of this John Rourke. There would be more of them in the night sky, more of them going to Eden. Rausch was alone here, but if Kuranami died, at least his mission would be complete. Nevertheless, whether the meddlesome Japanese died or not, Damien now knew the secret to entering the retreat. Granted, he did not know the combination for the massive vault doors that formed the retreat's inner defense, but enough explosives would take care of the doors.
Yes, that will work.
The important thing was that he knew the location. He knew how to penetrate the natural granite doors that formed the outer entrance, simple balance rocks. He read of ancient tombs guarded in such a fashion. So now, despite the sub-freezing temperatures, Rausch smiled. With Rausch's knowledge of the retreat, he now controlled Christopher Dodd, commander of the Eden Project, more surely than any number of men and guns. Dodd wanted power. If Kuranami was an obstacle to that, then Rourke was much more. But now, with the ability to kill Rourke while he was at his most vulnerable, kill Rourke and his entire loathsome family, Dodd would be a puppet to manipulate. Damien Rausch, numbing with the cold, would survive to restore the Reich. John Rourke would die for having deposed the leader, having allied himself with the cowardly weakling Dieter Bern against the glorious historic destiny of Nazism.
Yes, I will survive. And there will be a world such as mankind has never before known.
Sarah Rourke zipped into the German field parka. The garment radiated cold just touching it.
Oh, that's just my imagination.
Two of Colonel Mann's commandos carried Akira Kuranami between them. Kuranami slept under sedation, but his head tossed on the stretcher.
What is he still afraid of? The gunshot wound, exhaustion and exposure, the broken rib?
The rib might have penetrated his left lung, but there was no way to tell here. For a moment, she smiled. John didn't have an X-ray machine, though he had everything else at the retreat. Perhaps Kuranami was reliving the ordeal he suffered just in reaching the retreat, or of the attack on his life. Eight men, but all of them were dead now. Why did he say the German word for no? Over and over again until the medication took effect and he slept. The secret of the retreat was in good hands. Kurenami and Halverson, now Colonel Mann, and a few of his trusted commandos knew its location. She would as soon doubt Wolfgang Mann's intentions as her own.
Sorrow?
She looked away from Kurenami. Wolfgang Mann, already clad for the frigid outside, stood at the height of the three steps overlooking the great room from beside the main entrance.
Just a minute, Wolf.
She walked the three steps up from the great room and entered the storage area. It was here where the controls for water heating and other of the retreat's niceties were placed. Sarah killed the master switch for the water heaters and other switches, putting the retreat on minimal power as it always was when it was to be uninhabited for any length of time. The low setting provided power for overhead lighting, the red lights in the antechamber beyond the interior entrance, selected wall outlets that ran liquid crystal diode clocks and the like, but everything else went off. She noticed, with some interest, that the stores of supplies at the retreat had grown considerably, thanks to the Germans and their desire to accommodate John's every desire. Everything from ammunition, made to duplicate the federal cartridges he always preferred, to his favorite shampoo, to boots and shirts, toilet paper, synthetic motor oil, cigars, all the things the retreat could eventually run out of were here in greater quantity than ever before.
Well, what do you know, John?
Sarah Rourke shivered a little. She walked off, joining Wolfgang Mann beside the interior door, and prepared to seal the retreat and its secrets. The truck sat there unguarded, not even a likely driver or helper nearby. Perhaps it was some subtle portion of Antonovich's plan for him, perhaps just good fortune. But Vasily Prokopyev stole it regardless. In a half-track, climatically sealed, the bed loaded with synth fuel enough to take him from one end of the continent to the other and back, Prokopyev traversed the wild countryside easily. But the solitude set him to pondering a situation for which he had no tools to cope.
The Rourke family saves my life and stops nuclear annihilation of the planet at the second Chinese city. I act honorably in response and help them get away. Nonetheless, that act should mean my death. Instead, I am chosen to save my Soviet brethren by betraying them. This was not covered in my training.
He didn't know if he would ever understand. At least for another few minutes or hours, until his escape from the underground city was discovered, he was still the chosen leader of the KGB elite corps. Comrade Marshal Antonovich gave him that command in the aftermath of the vicious murder of Vladimir Karamazov.
Was it a vicious murder when Major Chemerovna killed her husband, the hero Marshal Karamazov? Or was it just a fireball? Who is right? Does even Comrade Marshal Antonovich know?
Now Prokopyev carried the secrets of the new particle beam technology. Marshal Antonovich gave Vasily the secrets to share with Dr. Rourke and the doctor's allies.
That much I know.
With the particle beam technology, if the Germans and others could make use of it, there would be sufficient strategic parity to prevent the forces of the Soviet Union from overrunning the planet, or should that fail, destroying the planet with nuclear weapons. Few spoke of it openly, and they were reckless to do so. But it was well known that the scientists believed even a single thermonuclear detonation might trigger the destruction of the planet's atmosphere. Those living in tomb-like cities beneath the ground might survive, but they would never be able to venture forth on the surface as normal human beings again.
That is not living.
Prokopyev kept driving west toward German lines, toward, he hoped, Dr. Rourke. Michael Rourke kept low, crossing the greenway from hedge to hedge, pausing in the grove of fruit trees. Where was Rolvag? Soviet helicopters sat everywhere in the park. The hammer and sickle hung limp over the presidential palace. Was Madame Jokli even still alive? Michael tried to follow the red-haired Icelandic policeman and his oversized dog, Hrothgar. They were both oversized. Rolvag reminded Michael of some gentle giant in a fairy tale, with his green tunic, his mighty staff, and the dog like some sort of enchanted wolf. They were moving inexorably toward the residential dormitory where Annie stayed when their father and Paul first found her here. Why go there? Why not go to the presidential palace if this was some solo rescue attempt Rolvag was planning? And was Madame Jokli Rolvag's sister? Bjorn Rolvag said that before slipping through the vent crack at the head of the tunnel, before Michael left Maria behind and ventured after him. But Rolvag's English was almost non-existent, so did Rolvag really mean to say the president of Lidveldid Island was his sister?
If we're not headed for the presidential palace, then why not go to someone like old Jan? He's a tough man and someone we can rely on in a fight. Or let's find some other members of the Icelandic police force. Though the Russians probably killed them right off.
Michael kept to the side of the path. The M16 tight in his fists. Two Soviet guards moved lazily on guard patrol at the base of the residential dormitory steps. Michael watched them intently. If Rovog got inside, then so could he. How was another matter.